This is Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Juliana Lydell uses the name June Swoon. She's originally from Sacramento, lives now in Los Angeles. Her debut 10-track solo record is This Town Could Be Big Enough for Both of Us. She talked recently with Insight producer Cody Drabble and described some of her songs.
I started them when I was living in the Appalachian Mountains. It was the first time I'd ever lived in snow, and that was the first place that I bought an electric guitar and kind of started putting bodies to these sorts of ideas I'd been having for a really long time since I had lived in Austin and San Diego. I moved to LA and did most of them in my bedroom that I was renting, which is maybe 8 feet by 8 feet. It's quite small. I think maybe comes across in the songs. It feels really, really intimate, I think. And part of that was recording a lot of it just by myself in a really small space, making a lot of mistakes and doing it again. It also got augmented in my friend's home studios in Los Angeles, and also in my friend's studio in Oakland and another friend's studio in Nashville.
So you've moved around a bit, Austin, San Diego, Sacramento, LA. How did you end up in the Appalachian Mountains?
So I had just finished my undergrad in cognitive linguistics at the University of San Diego, and I was in a relationship where my partner got a job offer. We went out there.
What's the closest major city?
Probably Richmond, Virginia. It's somewhat close to Asheville as well. The city itself was called Roanoke. I think some settlers went missing there once.
I've heard of Roanoke, yes. And you went missing in Roanoke, too.
I did. It was, you know, the person I was dating, he was gone a lot. And I think I watched maybe 3 seasons straight of Nashville, the TV show, and was thinking, well, what else can I do? I was applying to jobs that had to do with linguistics.
So that was your career path.
I thought I wanted to be a lady scientist, but it didn't end up happening. I was working as a substitute teacher out there. I worked as a cook. Yeah, I was really, really deeply bored, and I had a lot of time to play music. Well, a lot more than I had when I was working at a research lab and working at UC San Diego.
Bored because you were lonely?
It was extremely lonely. I couldn't afford to fly home for the holidays back to California, and I think of it now as a gift, because if I had stayed in California, I wouldn't have had that much time to really think about what I wanted to do and to have that much space to be creative.
So the boredom was really a necessary element to making this record.
I think so, and just sort of a deep loneliness. I have really good friends, I have a really good support network, and being removed from that and also having that absence. I had been in school for at least about 7 years, I think, between community college and UC San Diego, and there's a real lack of stimulation. When you're alone with yourself to that degree, there's a lot of things that you can have the opportunity to confront.
Had you played guitar before? Was this your first guitar purchase?
I had, growing up and in my teens, I had played keyboards in bands. My mom is a classical guitarist. I would play her acoustic guitar, but I had never owned an electric before I moved to Virginia. I remember going around to different, I had so much time. I like drove around to different guitar shops and tried out stuff until I found something I liked.
Tell me about Marrying Kind. What's the story behind the song?
I wrote that in summer of 2018, so I'd been in LA for a few months, and I had been working on this body of work for several months at that time after like a drive back across the country, and that song was really, it marks a turning point in the record. It definitely gets more, I think, experimental. When I was younger, I really left like gender out of my music, my songwriting. I wrote songs about space, and I wanted to be in like a quest narrative, and I didn't want it to really have much to do with my experience of being a woman. And all the songs I'd written up until Marrying Kind, I thought were about other people. And then when I wrote Marrying Kind and the words, "Surprise, I'm not the marrying kind like her," I wrote it and it felt really true. And you're conditioned to think that you need to be a certain kind of person, especially a certain kind of woman, maybe like a disassociative kind of woman, in order to have a successful relationship and turn a blind eye to things. And this song is really about kind of reconciling your true self and the self that you think you may have to be or society has told you that you have to be.
Picking cherries on the weekend, we couldn't tie them with our tongues. It was very wholesome. Sometimes you looked at me when I was looking down from the pier. Some think I'd make it from up here. You said, man, that's dark, thought we were having fun. I said, aren't we? Went with you to a party, your friends were tying the knot. It was picture perfect, except my face when someone told me you used to date. Said, isn't it such a shame? She's the one who got away.
That's Marrying Kind by June Swoon. I'm talking with Julie Liddell, the songwriter and multi-instrumentalist behind June Swoon. So when you write that song, Marrying Kind, and your other songs, are you writing it from a personal perspective or do you write it in character? Do you need a little bit of distance to get the words out?
I certainly need a bit of distance in some ways. Being on stage is actually not my favorite thing, surprisingly. June Swoon, I'm a big fan of like drag queens. I love Dolly Parton. And there was this hyper femininity that I really leaned into when I was writing this. But it allowed me to access these kinds of deep fears around vulnerability in relationships as a woman. So while not everything in these songs is necessarily nonfiction, definitely there's feelings that I really leaned into from my personal experience or things that have, you know, prohibited me from experiencing like very deep intimacy with people because there's a lot of fear there. It's a bit of a roller coaster in these songs to try to get into those deep sort of maybe even subconscious motivations for things in relationships and then also try to really face them head on. And
the title of the record is This Town Could Be Big Enough for the Both of Us. Of all the towns that you've talked about living in, which town are you talking about?
Oh, that's a good question.
Is it wherever you happen to be?
That's a good question. The title of the record was originally going to be Mustang Salad, which my friends were not happy about. I ended up writing this song. It's the title track. It's the first track on the record called This Town Could Be Big Enough for the Both of Us. And when I first came up with that title in the form of that song, and it ended up being just a really fitting title for the record because of the Western themes. It encompasses a lot when I think of a town, you know, standoff, like between two cowboys. I think about, you know, as a female artist, who's the other cowboy? Myself, you know, the version of me that's been taught to work towards something like domestic bliss, you know, opposed to my artist self. It could be me versus, you know, the person I'm in a relationship with. It's really, it could be a lot. And I hope that it's people that are listening to it. It could stand for a lot for them as well.
And you were on a bit of a Western kick while you were writing these songs.
I was. I really got into country music when I was living in Austin, but it was probably not super conventional country music. Like I said, I like Dolly Parton a lot. I like the band Timber Timber, even though I've been told it's pronounced Timber Tambor. I still like their music. And I also got really into like spaghetti westerns, like Sergio Leone. And I was listening to a lot of spaghetti western soundtracks when I wrote this record. I really like the idea also, you know, spaghetti western, it's an Italian's idea of the Wild West. And so we operate on these ideas of the Wild West that aren't even actually what it was like. And that really spoke to me a lot. And I think there's something really romantic about the Southwestern states. Like when I moved to Austin, I ended up in San Diego after that. And, you know, that's still the Southwest and kind of the flora and stuff down there. there's something really special about it. And I wrote this album from a place of seeing myself in a sort of desert.
It's sparse, and you're one of the only living creatures around.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about the cover image of the album.
Oh, absolutely.
It's a Polaroid?
It's a Polaroid.
And what are you wearing in this Polaroid?
First of all, it's a shoot I did with my friend Nico Bernal, and I'm wearing all white, and there's a white floral crown that I got from a thrift store. I had a bunch of props from that day. The floral crown, I didn't even think I was going to use it. My favorite thing that I had thrifted for this shoot was a trophy from Toastmasters that I had thrifted, and the trophy said second funniest. So I thought that was going to take more of a role, but turns out the font was pretty hard to read in the pictures, but it's in my house. But anyway, yeah, the Polaroid was taken in my dining room of my apartment where I wrote most of the record. There's a green background that you can see the edges of it in the Polaroid.
The first time I saw it, it reminded me a little bit of people who get a quickie wedding in Vegas or Reno.
Yeah.
Like a hastily thrown together.
That's perfect. Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, we took a lot of pictures that day, and looking at that one, I felt it was a great metaphor for the record as sort of dressing up as these different characters, especially, you know, something that's all white. It's definitely evocative of like a wedding or a bride, but then you can see the set dressing, so it's not a complete illusion.
How would you describe the look in your eyes?
I definitely think that Nico captured a sadness in that image, in that expression, that I think is really special and that I think speaks to the record. And it's sort of like almost like a wincing.
Mm-hmm.
It's a wonderful image. He's so talented.
I think that's a good place to pick up with the last track on the record. This is Blood from a Stone.
The next red light I hit, I'm dialing your number. I know I lost my nerve the past couple times. We got our own version of closure, but apparently it's not the forgetting kind. When you stone.
That's Blood from a Stone by June Swoon. Tell me a little bit about the story behind that one.
That one was one of the first ones I wrote when I was really deeply getting into kind of arranging with an electric and finding these really dark sounds and really deep kind of vibrations. That guitar riff that's in the chorus, I would like crank my amp, like the treble all the way down and the bass and mids all the way up, and distortion pedals and fuzz pedals. And when my roommate wasn't home, I would just play that riff and kind of let it go completely through my chest cavity. And it felt very healing to me. I was working at a bar in Virginia, and somebody said the phrase blood from a stone about something, and I had never heard it before. And I thought it was a really fun phrase, and I was kind of turning it around in my mind like a smooth rock for probably a few days. Song lyrics come first for me a lot, and melodies, and I write them in my car because I drive a lot. I was thinking about that phrase and turning it over, and that guitar riff was born out of me, just that phrase alone, Blood from a Stone. And as far as its placement on the record goes, you don't really know it at the beginning what you're making until it's kind of done. But looking at it as a whole, it's really about facsimiles of intimacy and, you know, really buying into the illusion.
And not quite getting there.
And not quite getting there, but then maybe you're thinking you are because you really want it to be all the way there. And then also these periods of really intense desolation where you do realize that it's not complete, the vision is not complete. But what's special content-wise with Blood from a Stone, I think, is that a lot of the record is kind of these highs and lows. And the narrator is, first of all, it's not a reliable narrator, but the narrator is always trying to self-correct and self-adjust the circumstances or change the relationship. There's this sense of closure about it because finally the narrator realizes that it wasn't their fault. It's not 100% their fault.
And that starting over is okay.
And it's the first time I think another person is truly implicated. The narrator might leave that really lonely desert. I had been writing music for a long time. I'd been thinking about a solo project for a long time. It hadn't really materialized. When I started working really hard on these songs, around the same time somebody told me about Margaret Glaspy, her record Emotions in Math. She made it several times before making a studio version. She made it over and over again.
She recorded it and re-recorded it
at home. And I thought, oh, that's what I'll do. That like seems like the best learning process that I would have. So I've made many, many versions of these songs. Blood from a Stone was one that I worked with quite closely with Nate Hopwood in Los Angeles. He's an engineer and sound designer, and we composed the strings together, and you can hear spurs in the chorus. That's something that he sampled. The way that it turned out, I think, is so lovely and just a wonderful capstone to the record. There's a lyric that says, I said my piece and counted up to 10 and back down again. But I didn't know this would be the last song on the record until it was all done, and then it really, I thought that would be perfect.
And it's track 10.
It's track 10.
And you double-track the vocals in that second half of the song.
I did. I tend to be really sparing with the harmonies that I track, just because I think it takes you out of that intimacy sometimes of feeling like you're just kind of alone with that voice. But that is one of the moments on this record that I chose to really go bigger with the vocals, and I think it's a very kind of classic country harmony.
How did you land on your artist name, June Swoon?
That's a great question. I was trying to name this project for most of 2018. I didn't name it until September 2018, so almost a year ago.
Well, let's work through the names that didn't make it.
I plugged my name into an anagram maker, my full name, so Juliana K. Lydell. I like plugging my name into this anagram thing. At first, I really wanted a mononym. I ended up on this word, Junera. So it's kind of like Pantera.
Okay.
Which I thought was super metal and I liked it. But it turns out someone, you know, in another country was using it. But I wanted to stick with June. So I was like, okay, June was at the beginning of Junera. And after many, many months and texting friends ideas and they just feel like, what? What is that?
Friends are on the receiving end of all these weird name pitches.
It's like, you know, 4 a.m. And I'm like, I think I found it. And they're like, no, you didn't. So June Swoon. I know, I realized that it rhymed with June, and a swoon is something that's very 1950s on a fainting couch. It had a vintage quality to it that I really liked, but also it could be a band name. Like, I think it kind of reminded me of, like, you know, modern baseball or American football or whatever, some sort of emote. So I like that it had that double purpose. But June Swoon is already a phrase, and if you Google it, unfortunately, you get a lot of search results for it, but it's...
It's either baseball teams failing baseball. Or the stock market crashing.
It's baseball or the stock market crashing, but it's a losing streak, especially in June, which I thought was fitting given the content of these songs tends to be a pretty strong losing streak romantically.
And June is wedding season.
It is. It was really perfect. I had my band in high school with my brother as well was a stock market term, which is funny. I guess maybe I have a future in finance. I don't know.
What was your brother and your high school band?
The Dreaded Diamond. It's like
it's I need another, to beef up on my stock market terminology.
It's another marketing term. Yep.
You've performed and recorded with a couple of other Sacramento bands. So what lessons did you learn from making those other records, performing in those other bands that you applied to this solo record?
You know, in past projects, I've been able to be on the sound engineering side a bit, getting to work out of bandmate studios, but I had never had complete creative control of a project. And this truly has turned out to be everything I like. Both things are really good, right? I love to collaborate with other people, too. It was important to me to see what I was capable of doing it by myself. And it's truly like, I don't know, when I was, you know, maybe 11 or something, my two favorite CDs, like my mom had bought me this Frank Sinatra compilation from Costco. And then I had, like, a friend from class, like, burnt me Deja and Tendu by Brand New and The Starting Line, something corporate. And, you know, they're not necessarily everybody's favorite genres, but it was really special to me to really touch every single piece of this record. Like, it was really different to do absolutely everything myself. And there was some moments where I didn't really realize how much work would go into it, working completely by yourself. I worked on it with no outside influence for about a year, just making different versions of it by myself. And then the summer of 2019, I started working with Nate Hopwood, and he really helped bring it kind of over the finish line and give it the kind of polish that has made it as special as it is now. It was special to really experience the fullness of being completely alone and being creative and getting to tap into these really wonderful creative places that I didn't even know that I was maybe capable of. But having the space to do that was great. And then also bringing other people into it at the end and letting them add, like, their touch to it.
And you're working on your own timeline. You're not constrained by anybody else's budget, anybody else's schedule.
I think being able to work in the box at home and getting the songs externalized so that you can really start dissecting them is really important. And I think that with all the tools that we have, I think that it's really accessible to be able to do that.
That's Julie Liddell. She's the songwriter and multi-instrumentalist behind June Swoon. And we're talking about her debut solo record, This Town Could Be Big Enough for the Both of Us. I want to talk about one more song, Cactus Tree. Let's listen to it, and then we'll talk about it after.
Honey, it's a secret. I hated you for not loving me like you should. But it made me feel so bad, so I just gave you more than I probably should. I survived.
So that's Cactus Tree. We're still in the Southwest in terms of lyrical imagery and the guitar production. Tell me about that song.
Absolutely. Cactus Tree was a song that I wrote after realizing, so I love Dusty Springfield. I haven't talked about her yet, but I really love Dusty Springfield. I love Patsy Cline. I had this moment where I listen to a lot of, like, Midwest emo. Like, that's what I grew up listening to, and math rock, obviously, being in someone who grew up in Sacramento. But I sort of realized that 1960s, like, pop and soul and doo-wop is kind of like the original emo. When I thought about emo bands, you know, growing up, you know, skinny guys with long hair, it's, like, very male-dominated. And then I thought about It's My Party and I'll Cry If I Want To and how hyper-feminine that is. There was, like, these currents of all these different thoughts, you know, commuting to work and whatever, and sitting down to write music at the end of a double shift or whatever. And Cactus Tree, I was getting interested in more compacted songwriting. I like Bright Eyes a lot, and there are these very tangential songs that I like and that I have definitely written in the past. And some of these songs on this record, you know, are longer. But Cactus Tree was a song that I was interested in making a lot of impact.
And what you return to on that song is that you can survive on less, just like a cactus, food and water and sunlight, but also, like, relationship, the sort of nourishment that comes with being with somebody.
Yeah. It was something my dad said to me, actually, about a relationship I was in. And my dad actually said, you know, you sure survive on very little for a long time.
And Ooh,
he's very insightful. He's very insightful. And it was true.
out of necessity or out of comfort? Is that your comfort zone or is that just testing yourself? What is the minimum amount of intimacy I can survive on?
So that is a really good question. And there's lots of different, like I said, facsimiles of intimacy or illusions of intimacy in this record. And I think Cactus Tree and American Dream are kind of like a side A and side B. You try to earn love from someone. American Dream, that's like wanting to buy someone whatever they want and buy them champagne and baseball game tickets and, you know, which is a fun power dynamic to write a song about wanting to drive someone around in your company Cadillac and you're, you know, a woman treating a guy. But Cactus Tree is kind of the side B to that, where you did all these things and you gave them everything you wanted and that intimacy that we all crave and that closeness is still not there. It's a necessary but very painful realization. It's not something that you can earn. If it's something that you feel like you're earning from someone, that means that you can also, you know, fail to earn it.
I've broken this one up into two parts. The first part sounds a little bit like a Pavement record to me, and then we'll get to the second half of the song where it takes a genre shift.
How do you afford what you hate to want?
So that's the first part of American Dream. Tell me about coming up with the hook that drives that song.
There was a really wonderful period of time where I feel like I really fell in love with playing guitar.
Are you still in love with playing guitar?
I am.
Okay, good.
Now we're in a committed relationship, but there was a wonderful honeymoon period.
Got it.
This was one of the first songs. I think I actually wrote the song on an acoustic guitar. So this is before I even bought an electric. It's always been really a really fun riff for me to play. There's a lot of sounds and textures in it, like you mentioned, Pavement. I grew up listening to Pavement. There's something really comforting about the guitar tones to me that I used and familiar, you know, 12-year-old me would have really liked. And that's a really great feeling.
It's like Teddy Grahams and Milk. It was just kind of like the sweetness to it. And then it takes a turn. Let's get into the second part of the song.
I guess I've never liked anyone.
So on the bridge there, it sounds like you just boarded a plane for Hawaii. And then it lands in San Diego and you're full on pop punk.
Amazing. You got it. Perfect. I'm happy it comes across.
So tell me about some of the influences that you put together on this record.
While I was making this record, I was listening to a lot of Dusty Springfield. I really like the band Tangled Hair. There's a band called Adult Jazz. I tend to like a lot of music that's either really intense pop song structure or completely experimental.
And it meets in the middle.
And it meets in the middle. I think, you know, depending on what day it is, the person I wake up as, I want to sing a song like either one of those things.
So that song's a bit of a rocker. When you play it live, how does the crowd respond?
It's really fun to play live. You know, I've been playing these songs for the past year or so. I went on tour last spring, and that was my first time playing them with a band. And then I put out this record. In the past couple weeks have been really, really fun. It's really fun to have this sort of very, very intimate country, you know, lounge singer feeling in some of the songs. And then the other songs, you just want to, like, you know, sing them along with other people and have that, you know, house show or like living room show feeling to them. So it's a dream.
Are you writing new songs for the next record or just focusing on this one?
Oh, I'm kind of always writing songs, but it's going to be definitely a different recording process. I did a lot of things backwards and sideways and upside down. I really did build it and demolish it and write it again and work on it with new people. And it was pretty confusing, but it came out with something that was tried and true. And this next recording process, I want to do something that's equally scary and different, something equally satisfying creatively and not exactly the same.
Are you going to take this record on tour?
I am. I'm going to be touring to support the record in the spring, definitely up the West Coast, and maybe I'm a little bit on top of that. It's been a really exciting debut. I'm just pleased as punch about everything that has happened over the recording process and being able to tour last spring and workshop these songs. And now that it's out, I'm really excited to go on tour in a couple months. I'm really looking forward to it.
I really like the record. Thanks for sharing it. It's called This Town Could Be Big Enough for the Both of Us. Julie Liddell, congratulations.
Thank you so much.
And that was Juliana Liddell, singer-songwriter behind June Swoon. Her solo debut album is This Town Could Be Big Enough for Both of Us. She talked with Insight producer Cody Drabble. You can find more information at capradio.org/insight. That's Insight for today. I'm Beth Ruyak. Thanks for joining us.
Disappointed.